Last case this afternoon is Aspen Builders and Remodelers. I hope I pronounced this right, versus Shauna Raich. The court file number is 82-0246. As all parties are aware, this matter is being conducted on Zoom and it is being recorded. An audio recording will be available tomorrow. However, our rules do prohibit anyone recording it themselves, either counsel or parties, or anyone out there, you know, in the internet world. So please don't do that. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their arguments in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes. And finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So whenever you're ready, Mr. Anderson, if you just tell us who you are with a loud voice, you may begin, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jordan Anderson. May it please the court. I am the attorney of record and representing Shauna Raich and Twiggs Salon Spa, Inc. In this case, in their appeal. The primary crux of the appeal in this case, Your Honors, is that there was a trial to the bench, and the district court made a conclusion of law that the parties had entered into a series of contracts. And that series of contracts, or the contract or series of contracts, the nature of the relationship between the parties was the point of bitter dispute between the parties in their case, specifically whether the work that was being done by the construction company was pursuant to the contract that my client understood and agreed and signed or had agreed to and intended to follow through, which had a specific area that was going to be built out and a specific dollar amount that it was going to cost her. And the Aspen's position, which was that they built out this salon, but that my client had asked for additional pieces that weren't technically included in the original build out. And without having specific dollar amounts, she had agreed to a substantial number of deviations or additional things that she had wanted done, which Aspen says these are additional, and my client always believed these are not additional. There's one exception, which is a specific couch that had been built, which my client knew and agreed to upfront that she would be paying extra for. And so that's not being challenged. And that one was ultimately paid, and quite promptly paid. The district court cited as a finding of fact that the parties had entered into a series of contracts. The district court did not cite or make any specific findings about what date any of the individual series of contracts was entered into, what the offer was, what constituted acceptance on behalf of my client, why my client's expectation that these items would have been covered under the original contract was incorrect, or why she would have known that that wasn't the case. And ultimately, the court didn't make any findings specifically about the series of contracts that the court held my client accountable for. My client's position is that a contract, if it's going to be entered into outside of the original contract that was entered in this case, which had a specific dollar cap, a contract needs to have the elements of a contract: offer, acceptance, consideration. The definiteness of the offer is specifically problematic in this case, and a meeting of the minds. And if you don't have specific findings that my client knew that she was asking for an additional $25,000 worth of cabinets, and you don't have a specific finding that my client knew that that was the case and agreed to pay extra, well, then you don't have that specific contract established in the series of contracts. In the entire series of...
I understand your argument. There was an original contract for around $192,000, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then the district court found that on page 8 of the order that plaintiff has established the parties entered into a series of contracts to perform additional work beyond the scope of the additional contract. Some of the additional work was discussed in person or over the phone, and some was discussed in texts and emails in the record, and cites findings of fact 15 through 18. And then the district court finds that Ayaz credibly testified regarding these requests and agreements for additional work, and credibly testified that he informed defendant of the cost of the work performed both within the original contract and above the original contract. So it appears that, and then the district court's findings 14 through 18 talk about the exchange between the two and some examples of that additional work. So can you explain why those findings aren't sufficient to support the district court's determination that the parties entered into a series of additional contracts?
Yes, Your Honor. First, there's no discussion or specific findings of fact with regard to what was offered to my client. My client has no communication delivered to her. There's no finding that says she was offered this additional object is this at this additional price and agreed to accept it. The court cannot generalize and say they were generally working together, they all agreed and everything was good, when that is the specific issue that's being challenged by my client. There is no offer. There was no acceptance. There was no consideration at that point because that work was already supposed to be accomplished under the original contract. Mr. Ayaz and Aspen were already obligated to build that space out, and there's no specific findings for any of those offers and acceptances. And the examples that are provided by the court also don't show any meeting of the mind, and there's no findings about the meetings of the minds. Now, Aspen, in their response to this appeal, have argued that the court found that the statement of the contract was delivered in the form of the invoice. An invoice is something that gets sent after the agreement has already been made. Aspen had already done the work when they sent the invoice. My client never had any information about what the dollar amount was prior to the invoice. And we challenged the invoices, and the district court made findings that the invoices were proven as the value that was contributed. But even if that value had been contributed, there's no evidence and there's no reason why the district court took the work that was done on the property out of the original $192,000. And frankly, my client.
Well, to that point, counsel, I believe the record reflects that that Ayaz testified that he finished the work called for under the original contract, and testified that he informed Reisch. Am I pronouncing her name correctly?
It's Rash, Your Honor.
Rash, excuse me, Rash.
No problem.
Informed her in July of 2014 that they were over budget on the March contract, and that she asked him to perform a series of additional work items. So is that evidence not sufficient to show that the additional work that was done after that time, that there was an agreement as to those items and payment for those items?
Yes, that's wholly insufficient, Your Honor. For example, one of the items was for cabinets. Now there's a lien release that shows the amount that was actually paid to the cabinetor in the evidence and in the record. And the total amount that was paid to the cabinetor was somewhere in the neighborhood of $15,000. And the total amount claimed is in excess of $30,000. And that's what Mr. Ayaz says was in addition to the underlying contract. Now, my client said, where's the money that was supposed to be allocated under the original contract? And there's no question that he said on numerous occasions, this is over, this is under, we've got some money that we can work with in this section and applied it to a different section. But there is no clear finding that says my client ever agreed to go beyond the 192 with any of the specific things that are being sought right now. And there's no real indication in the record as to why those things wouldn't have been covered in the first place under the original contract. Now, my client got a two-page contract and testified very clearly that she was under the impression that she was choosing the fixtures under that contract. The court of the lower court didn't find that credible, and that's the credibility determination of the lower court. But it doesn't establish the opposite just because my client wasn't credible in her testimony saying she believed that all of this was covered under the original contract. That doesn't in turn mean that my client is obligated to all of this with all of the additional sums without being able to cross-reference that against the $192,000 that the builder had already been paid and for which we still never got an accounting. We discovered in the course of the trial that Mr. Ayaz was building profit levels on and subcontracting to himself and building multiple layers of profitability into his contract and into the way that he was managing the budget. But we did not get any documentation that supported any more than about $50,000 worth of costs or money actually being spent under the $192,000. So my client is just standing there saying, where's the money that I already spent? Where is that before I pay you more? And since we never got to the bottom of where is the money that they've already been paid?
You know, I mean, she didn't spend any of that money. That was a tenant improvement given to her by the landlord. So, but anyway, I'd like to shift from that issue. I'm sorry, go ahead, Mr. Anderson.
Yes, Your Honor, the tenant improvement allowance was not given. The tenant improvement allowance was borrowed at an interest rate from the landlord and is being paid back and was required to be paid back under the terms of the lease. It was not free money that my client got to spend. It was money that my client borrowed.
And, okay, fair enough. I stand corrected. Could I shift to the personal liability issue? Apart from the whole argument about whether this was or was not raised on appeal, I apologize, I don't have it. I'm trying to find it in the addendum or the record, but your whole argument is she only, to the extent she did anything, it was only in her corporate capacity as the president of this company. And you rely on that one document, that one exhibit. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Her signature on the document?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, well, that's the only document, Your Honor. She didn't have any work.
The problem I have with that is, as I recall the document, first of all, it doesn't even say on top, you know, of the letterhead, I've forgotten, you know, Twig Salon Spa Inc. It just says Twigs. And then in the letter line, it doesn't even say as signed by president of thank you, Judge Cochran. It doesn't even say as president of Twig Salon Inc. Incorporated. So I'm hard pressed to understand how that somehow only limits. I mean, that document doesn't seem to, in any way, suggest a limitation to simply corporate liability. So explain to me why I'm wrong.
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a very important question. The reason that it's not creating personal liability is because there's no personal guarantee. There's only one signature here. There's only one contract being entered into, and there aren't multiple parties being identified on that contract. There's absolutely no indication on that contract to my client that she was being asked to personally guarantee her company's salon build out. And a personal guarantee is a very important term of a contract if it's being relied on by the drafter of the contract, which was Aspen in this case, in order to secure their consideration and willingness to do the contract.
Well, I mean, I agree there's no personal guarantee, but you don't need one. I mean, that letter is her signature. I have accepted the proposal and received my pre-lien notice, signed Shauna Raish. And then at the top, it's not even addressed to Shauna Raish, Twig Salon, Inc., President, blah, blah, blah. It's just, you know, Shauna Raish, Twig Salon. I mean, speaking for myself only and not my treasured colleagues, I think there are lots of cases that say that's means you're personally on the hook, and you know you don't have a corporate shield.
So you believe that there are lots of cases where
one not only do I believe that, I think I actually wrote one of them. So okay. I don't have it in front of me, but you know, I'll try and find it before we get the opinion out. I just don't think that letter is a clear indication of a limitation to only corporate liability. I mean, I think it's got to be, you know, as president and CEO, you know, of what, you know, Acme Incorporated, signed, you know, Joe Blow, president. I'm not so sure that does it, but, you know.
Well, in response to that, just brief.
Yes, please do. I've wasted a lot of your time, so I will give you another minute or so on that question before.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. So for the purpose of this contract or any real contract, the drafter in this case was Aspen. To the extent that there's any confusion or lack of clarity, now I didn't raise that argument to the lower court because I don't see this as a confusing or vague allocation of the risk. I don't see Mr. Ayaz personally signing it. You know, he's signing it only for his business. I don't see any communication about a personal guarantee. And in fact, Mr. Ayaz had plenty of information and knew where to send the bill to. He sent it to the landlord, knowing that it was being funded by the landlord. There was never any question about that. But for my client's sake, there's no indication on this document anywhere that it is both the corporation and her personally that are signing up for liability. And since there's not that information, I believe that the contract should only apply to one of them. And in this case, I believe that the clear intended beneficiary of all the work was Twiggs Salon Spa, not my client personally. And thank you for your time.
Just a quick clarification, if I could, Judge Conley.
Go right ahead, Judge Halbert.
Mr. Anderson, am I correct, though, that the testimony at trial really didn't go to this issue of corporate representative, but she took the position that it was not her signature. Isn't that how this was argued at trial? And the judge didn't find that credible?
Yes. At trial, Your Honor, my client testified and that she believed that her signature had been forged. She believed that it had been traced over. And she did not believe that she had signed it and did not believe that she had signed it on the date and at the time that it stated. And she provided the email ad or an email to the court saying that there was evidence that Mr. Ayaz didn't have it signed at that point either, because Mr. Ayaz had later sent an unsigned version of it and only produced the signed version of it after litigation had begun.
But with respect to your client's testimony that it was not her signature, the district court did not accept that, correct?
The district court did not agree that it was not her signature, but she did independently testify that that it was only intended to be her company that was personally or that was responsible or liable under this the original contract. Now, there's no documentation for any of the other contracts. So to the extent that this is a breach of contract for her personally and against the company on the, you know, oral contracts, that the series of contracts, that's even more attenuated. There's no information at all to justify both holding the corporation and piercing the corporate veil and holding the individual also responsible. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
You did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. You will have rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court. My name is Michael Mahoney. I am counsel to Aspen Builders and Remodelers, and I'd like to focus my time on my client's cross appeal, unless there are any questions carrying over from Judges Conley and Cochran. I'd like to move on to the cross appeal. My client, Aspen Builders, is pointing out to this court that there was an error of law made by the trial judge with respect to the account stated arguments. As Judge Cochran correctly pointed out, the trial judge made the correct findings based upon the information that's contained in all the emails and correspondence, and stated clearly that she had read all of them and found that information to support the conclusion with respect to an offer acceptance specifically identified prices and items. In addition, the trial court pointed out that there were statements, invoices that were provided, and that 30,000 of those invoices were paid, meaning that they were received, they were read, they were understood. But there's a series of invoices that were then sent and not paid. Mr. Ayaz testified that he provided all of his services and all of his supplies and products at a cost to him basis, and that his understanding and arrangement and agreement was he would be immediately paid for those because he was giving them to her on such a discounted basis. And then when he was not paid, he sent an invoice stating that he was billing her for 12% additional interest on the unpaid balances. The trial court spent
Mr.
time-
Mahoney, yes, Judge when Conklin. Was that first indicated that there would be a finance, or that he was adding a finance charge?
Well, there's testimony that he made the statement to her in late 2014, and then there's invoices that immediately follow that. And so there's a statement in the record with respect to charging, and then the invoices themselves, which we've attached to the, they're in our addendum. I believe
so there's, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's one invoice from January, I believe, that were a finance charge of the ones that are in dispute. One in your addendum at page 17 that has a finance charge of $565.76.
I think Judge Cochran, I think that's
the first place it shows up.
That's the first invoice reference to it. That's correct.
And then on the next page, there's one from July where it reflects a $2,650 finance charge, and it makes clear that it's computed at 12%.
Correct.
Over the principal balance.
Correct.
Given that the 12% is first indicated on an invoice in July, and then in September, the lawyers get involved, has there really been an unreasonable amount of time here in terms of, I mean, I think you're arguing that there wasn't a sufficient objection until September. The district court found that there wasn't any assent, but setting that aside for a minute and focusing on the time issue, is 2 months, you're trying to, you know, go back to January, but when you look at the invoices themselves, it looks to me like the 12% doesn't appear until July. So then we're really only talking about 2 months.
The reference to it appears on the first invoice item, but it doesn't say 12%. You have to calculate. You have to.
Right, and it's not, there's no indication it's accruing for sure. It's just a flat dollar amount.
Correct. Correct. But the reference
go ahead, sorry.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Judge Cochran.
I'm just circling back to my question. Given that, that it wasn't made clear on an invoice until July, you know, how did the district court err in concluding that there wasn't mutual assent? You know, that under the case law, the district court is correct in citing the case law that an other side's failure to object for an unreasonable amount of time constitutes prima facie evidence of the accuracy of the account set forth. And so here, how is 2 months an unreasonable amount of time?
Two months is not an unreasonable amount of time. The argument that Aspen is making is that the notice was given at the end of the year. It was also given that a finance charge would be added. It's a number. It is not a good. It is not a services. It cannot be confused that it was anything other than interest. And that's the period of time. So that notice was given that interest was going to be charged because these accounts were so old. And there was never anywhere in the record an objection to the interest. The trial judge's error is she made the finding that there was no assent, there was no email, there was no statement assenting to it. Our argument is that as a matter of law, when the notice is sent, I'm going to charge you interest, and there is never a response, a written response, I object to the interest for 8 months. That as a matter of law establishes the account stated.
Well, given the district court's finding about assent, that depends on the factual record. Would you agree with that?
Well,
whether there's mutual assent.
Not quite. The mutual assent, I think, is a legal conclusion, has to be supported by a set of facts.
So it's a mixed question of fact and law.
It is. And because it's a mixed fact, I'm sorry, spoke over you.
Well, as to the factual side of it, the record does include emails from, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to mispronounce your name. Rish, right?
Rash.
Rash. From
took me a while.
Rash, stating that she had concerns about the invoices and wanted to discuss them and meet with them. So she is basically saying she questions all of these charges. And given that, it wouldn't really make sense for her to pinpoint the finance charge. In light of that, how can we find that the district court erred in its, you know, in its determination?
Judge Cochran, the way you described it is she questioned the invoices. The record, I believe, makes clear that she asked for a meeting and she said, I want to meet with you. And the case law that we provided, particularly the Fagery lawyer's bill case, indicated that a question, comments, pushing back and forth, none of that is sufficient to establish a written objection. So Ms. Rash never sent any written objection to the invoices, never sent any written objection to the finance charge. So as going back to your question about, isn't the record clear? I believe the record's clear. There's no written objection, and invoices for amounts and interest over a period of time establishes as a matter of law, the amounts stated are sufficient to create assent. The purpose of the account stated argument is that it creates a basis for the equivalent of quasi-contract conclusion. And do you have a question for me?
Yeah, if we were to agree with you, wouldn't we only be talking about the $2,650 and the $565.76? Because I don't think there was any argument below that your client is entitled to interest accrued after the date of the invoices.
No, there was specifically. We raised the argument in our findings of fact and proposed conclusions of law. I believe that's index 59, and I believe you'll find it at paragraphs 99, 100, and 130. We raised the argument.
Can you cite me to any case law that suggests that including it in a proposed finding of fact or is and conclusions of law is sufficient to preserve an issue for appeal?
Yes. The cases that we cited were, I think there are three of them at the beginning of our standard of review. And we pointed out that when this is an appeal from without post-trial motions, it's the record that forms the basis for establishing elements which may be appealed. The record in this case consisted of the trial record, the arguments made at the trial record, and the proposed findings of fact, conclusions of law that are submitted to the court. That's the only basis upon which the court could do the analysis, those three elements. So if I may continue on the argument, there's two parts of the response to our argument. One is a response to the argument that Aspen, that the contracts are basically merged into and part of the basic $192,000 contract. And you can't have or establish account stated because there's a written contract. The cases that we provided indicate, and I think the law is clear, that in order to have a bar to an account stated, there has to be a written contract that covers the same subject matter that the parties have agreed upon. Again, back to the Fagery case, we've got circumstances in which bills are sent, the bills are for goods and services. After a period of time when those goods and services aren't paid, then there's an additional invoice which covers the finance charge. So the original contract, the $192,000 contract, had no reference to it. The subsequent series of contracts all deal with offer and acceptance of specific goods, specific prices, specific delivery. They do not deal with the subject of interest or finance charges. Those only came up after the invoices were not paid. So what crazy routine could happen is that would mean that, like in the Fagery case, if lawyer sends bills, bills aren't paid, and after a year of billing, and now they start deciding to add finance charges, the argument would be, can't add finance charges at that point. That's what typically happens in most vendors. They send the bills arrive, customer doesn't pay. Then after a while, they begin to add the interest charges. So the argument in the case law with respect to a written contract that bars account stated does not apply in circumstances where vendors are providing invoices, matters change, and they then add the account stated. The argument about corporate veil, I want to go back to the argument about corporate veil. That argument was never raised. The only argument that appeared at the trial was that Ms. Rash, as Judge Conley pointed out, she claimed that she was not responsible to pay it. And the citation to the record provided by Mr. Anderson is page 420 of the transcript at 13. And the argument simply is there's no evidence in the record that Ms. Rash agreed to pay. That's not a corporate veil argument. Corporate veil argument is it's the obligation of a corporation. And the two-page contract that Ms. Rash said she didn't sign, at the top, it's addressed to Ms. Rash. And one of the construction arguments that all lawyers go through is you'll look at the signature line, George Ayaz. He signed Aspen Builders and Remodelers, Inc. So anyone reading these would see there is a corporation. Mr. Ayaz is signing for a corporation. The invoice,
does it matter that the contracts at issue here were not that for that $192,000, but additional contracts found by the district court?
I don't understand the question. I'm sorry, I missed maybe the first few words.
Well, you're arguing that under the contract that was signed, that contract was for the original $192,000, right?
Correct.
And the amounts that are at issue here are amounts for the additional contracts found by the district court.
Correct.
And so what I'm wondering is how does the signature on the original contract speak to liability under these additional contracts?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was talking about the single argument that a corporate veil defense was raised. And my point was it was never raised. Now to answer your question, that the evidence in the record, which consists of the emails, the correspondence, the written record, and there's hundreds of them are between Ms. Raish and Mr. Ayaz at Aspen. there's no comments in any of them indicating that it's a Twigs, a corporation communication. So if I answered, did I answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Well, my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Mahoney. Mr. Anderson, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. So there's a couple of items that I wanted to respond to that were raised in the Aspen reply brief. First, there's an argument that that the court findings didn't need to be challenged. The specific findings that Aspen had failed to prove the parties agreed to a finance charge. Aspen now argues that they were not required to bring a motion for amended findings to the lower court if they intended to challenge that finding here. That's incorrect. And the case that was cited that Aspen attempts to distinguish is a family court case, but it's a family court case where the court made specific findings, and those findings were challenged to this court, to the Court of Appeals. Specific findings are required when a trial is tried to the bench under Rule 55, I believe. It might be 54, but the court's required to make specific findings supporting its conclusions of law. The conclusion or the statement the parties entered into a series of contracts is a conclusion of law, just like the statement. It's a statement of fact that Aspen failed to prove that the parties had agreed to a finance charge. That's a factual statement, so that's a finding of fact by the court, and the finding of fact stands so long as it's supported by any record evidence. Now, Aspen hasn't come to this court with evidence showing that the parties ever did agree to a financing charge, and therefore that issue isn't even before the court, whether or not the parties agreed to a finance charge, because the finding was not raised to the lower court first. The other issue that I wanted to make sure that I brought back up. That's the same argument. So Aspen argued now today that the specific terms of the contracts, the series of contracts, included an agreement by Aspen, by Mr. Ayaz, that he would give a discounted basis and provide the materials at cost, provided that Ms. Rash or Twiggs would get it paid immediately when the invoices were sent. That's not even testimony that I think was in the original trial. But if that's the argument that's being proposed here or pursued here, it stands to like it's worth pointing out that that's a term that is the basis upon which Twig or Aspen is looking for their interest to be granted, but that term was never even testified to in the lower court, and that as a specific term to the series of contracts would have been the kind of thing that would have lent some sort of credibility to the idea that there was just a series of oral contracts or a series of mismatched contracts. Again, it's not a term that was ever discussed. And the fact that counsel is adding terms to this series of contracts at the appellate level just shows that there was no series of contracts. There was no series of offers and acceptances. There was no opportunity for each of these different items on the invoices for my client to agree or disagree with the idea that she would be paying interest or be paying them immediately. There's no indication at all that they would be paid immediately or that there was any negotiation around having those invoices or items paid immediately from funds other than the tenant improvement allowances. And the lower court didn't make such a finding. There's no record evidence that supports such a finding, and there's no indication that the record evidence, so there's no argument in my colleague's memorandum that shows where he believes that my client was told that or where that evidence was ever offered into the record. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Anderson. Thank you very much, Mr. Mahoney. The matter is submitted. That being our last case of the day, we are adjourned.
Bye all.